Well, thanks very much, and thanks very much for having me back. I really do appreciate the return invitation. Last year, I talked a lot about structural changes that have happened in our financial system and the implications that they had for housing prices and household debt and all the other aggregate things that we look at. And I also talked a little bit about cyclical behaviour in the market. Now, it sometimes seems that most conversations about financial stability devolve into a discussion about housing. And the Reserve Bank has, for a long time, put considerable energy into analysing developments in the household and housing sectors and the risks that they might pose. And it seems that in recent years, other central banks have increased the scope of their analysis and are now putting similar emphasis on these areas as we've done for a long time. And you can just see that in the share of pages in their financial stability reviews devoted to these topics. Now, there are at least three reasons for this collective shift. One's reasonable, and two, in my view, are less reasonable. In some senses, housing has genuinely become more important to central banks. Housing prices and housing-related debt have increased relative to the rest of the economy. Housing-related lending is a large fraction of bank lending and bank balance sheets. And in some countries, lending standards remain quite easy compared with practices in Australia. So in principle, there could be some near-term risks in some places. There's another thing that people have responded to, which is that the US housing bust is the thing that sparked the last financial crisis. And most people don't realise that households defaulting on mortgages isn't usually the trigger for a bust or a financial crisis. And the third thing is that the macroprudential tools that policymakers around the world have been designing do seem to be easier to design to lean against borrowing for housing than against the other sources of risk that we might care about. Now, an enduring theme in financial stability analysis is that it isn't enough just to look at the averages and the aggregates. Even though our concern is the stability of the system as a whole, we've got to drill down to the details and find where the risks might lie. So today, what I'd like to do is take a step back and reflect on one important detail about property markets, that they're physical structures. We can't forget that this is a market for residential buildings. They're bought and sold, inherited and passed down, renovated or neglected, and occasionally knocked down to make way for something new. And all through that life cycle, they're fixed in place on a given piece of land, which itself has location value. Now, if buildings are fixed in place, their arrangements in space will change only slowly. So we come to the observation that I made at this conference last year, that Australia's cities are unusually low density. Only New Zealand comes close. This is, in fact, exactly the same graph I showed last year. This low density is all the more remarkable given that many of the cities in both countries are geographically constrained. They cannot expand in all directions. Oceans, mountains, and national parks block some sides. As we'll see, both the low density and the geographic constraints matter to the dynamics of the market, and thus they could matter for financial stability. Now, on top of these geographical attributes, there are powerful economic forces that shape the development of cities and the spatial patterns within them. Perhaps the most important is distance. Travel has costs. It takes time. The car reduced those costs and time 20th century suburbanisation, but it did not completely overcome the tyranny of distance within cities, and in many cases it replaced it with the tyranny of traffic congestion. And what that means is that there's an old 19th century model of land use that's still a pretty good starting point for thinking about space within cities even today, and it's the von Thunen-Mills model of the central place. That model starts the idea of a central place, a market or business district. Higher value activity congregates close to the centre, that's the steeper curves. Land prices and rent are lower the further from the centre you go. Are there more recent models that allow for complex usage patterns? There can be sub-centres further out and edge cities that attract activity to the lower cost fringes. Now, there certainly are sub-centres within Australian cities. Some of them actually started out as separate towns that joined up with the expanding capitals. But if we look at the spatial pattern of employment in major Australian cities, the single centre model is not a bad fit. The 2011 census actually recorded the addresses of people's workplaces as well as their homes. So we can actually build maps of job density in different places. And so the next little sequence of graphs shows job density for the four largest Australian cities, disaggregated by local government area. Okay, there's Sydney. You can see how much denser it is in the centre. This clicker is a little bit. Melbourne. Brisbane. Unfortunately, their LGAs are quite big. And Perth. At the level of the local government area, at least, jobs are concentrated in central business districts and the areas immediately surrounding them. And if you look, the numbers are quite small on the slide, but if you look at the scale here, it's exponential. The big differences in density. That sort of lower, sort of slightly yellower shade at the edge there in Perth is a density of between 30 and 50 jobs per square kilometre. The central business district is somewhere between 2,700 and 10,000 jobs per square kilometre. It's a massive difference in density. I think that's important to focus on. Turns out the pattern of residence is similar, though not quite as pronounced. There's Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and Perth. So population density is higher near the centres, and it declines rapidly. And again, the scales on these graphs are exponential, so each darker shade is an order of magnitude higher density. Now, some of the outermost districts in these cities still contain agricultural land and a good fraction of national parks. So it isn't that surprising that population densities are very low in those places. But I find it interesting that even some quite middle-ring suburbs, you know, particularly if we go back, say, to Melbourne, some of those quite middle-ring suburbs have quite low density. They're not that much denser. Part of the reason for the higher population density close to the centre is historical. The inner parts of cities are older, and they were built when we had to live more compactly. As incomes rose, people wanted bigger, nicer homes. As cars became more common, the cost of locating further out declined, and it became feasible to have those bigger homes. Some of the older homes got renovated to be consistent with our higher modern incomes and aspirations. But in general, the newer homes further out tend to be bigger and sit on bigger blocks of land. What we don't see is much expansion of block sizes in the inner areas. The land parcels stay quite small. And of course, it would be a legal hassle to consolidate land titles like that, but people generally don't even try. The block sizes stay small. And that's because what people in the inner areas are doing is trading off space against place and price. Distance versus space. It's exactly the trade-off that's driving that central place model that I showed earlier. And as you can see, the bigger the city, the denser the inner ring is relative to the outer rings. In regional centres, that trade-off of space for place has not been so stark. You can see the yellow bars on the right-hand side of the whole of town densities of some of our major non-state capitals. The trade-off of space for place has not been so stark, and the overall density is generally between the middle and outer rings in the larger cities, so that there's less of a trade-off. Now, as cities expand, the existing outer areas stop being fringe and become desirable locations that are relatively closer than the new fringe. And what that means is the same property will cost a lot more the closer it is to the action. The power of the central place is even more striking if we directly contrast where the jobs are with where the employed people live. What the next few maps show is the ratio of jobs in an area to employed people living there. So here's Sydney, for example. Places with ratios well above one are employment centres, job magnets attracting commuters from elsewhere in the city, even from outside the city. Places with ratios well below one, which is actually most of Sydney here, are the commuter districts, the dormitory suburbs. As you can see, there are factory districts away from the CBD in Melbourne. You can see down in the southeast there. And there are office parks on the way out to Macquarie University in Sydney. But in all of these cities, the CBD is still the job magnet. What's really interesting about all this is seeing how this pattern has changed. Now, so far, we can only see what's happened between the last two censuses, and only for the cities where the local authority boundaries have not changed much in that time. So, unfortunately, from here on in, I can't show you Brisbane. That said, what we can see is that the absolute increases in both job density, so here's Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, and population density, again, Sydney, Melbourne, Perth. The absolute increases in both job density and population density are greater in the already dense inner areas. In fact, many of the inner areas have become even greater job magnets in recent years. There are some middle and outer areas that added people, but not so many jobs to their job to worker ratio. And so their job to worker ratios actually declined. So here, the reddish coloured areas are the areas where the job to worker ratio increased, and the sort of pale grey is where they decreased. And so you can see that some of the inner areas had increases in the job to worker ratio, whereas the people who live there who work, and you can see some of the outer areas did too, but there are plenty of places where that ratio fell, right through Sydney, similarly in Melbourne, and there's Perth. Now, what's interesting is that the CBDs actually tended to see small declines in their job-to-worker ratios, and that's because a lot of their new residents were students. So they had a lot of new residents, but their populations rose even more, and some of them are working, but they're not necessarily working in the area. Now, where you've got declining job-to-worker ratios in some of these outer areas, it means that there are a lot of people moving to those areas, but they're facing longer commutes than they would have if they'd stayed closer in. So they're facing longer commutes than before. And so the trade-off between space and place is getting steeper. Locating on the fringe is relatively less attractive than it used to be, and not only because the fringe is moving further out. And you can see that trade-off in relative prices of housing over time. Inner ring properties have, if anything, become more expensive relative to outer ring properties in recent years. So this graph shows the ratio of inner ring to outer ring median prices for detached houses across the cities. And you can see that between 2006 and 2013, those ratios have tended to rise. And the larger the city, the greater the absolute premium in general. And it's especially obvious during upswings in prices. People then shift out in search of more affordable housing until prices further out catch up. You can also see the changing trade-off in commute times and distance to work. There is survey data that suggests that average commute times have risen since 2006 in at least some of those cities that we're showing here. Now, that choice between space, place and price can be made a little bit less stark, either by bringing the jobs to the people or by bringing the people to the jobs. It's clear from the graphs that I've just shown that Australia isn't doing that much of the first. While telecommuting on some days can at least avoid some travel time, jobs are actually, if anything, showing an even greater tendency to congregate in existing centres. Even social infrastructure doesn't easily follow population to the low-density fringes. Sydney's newest university, Notre Dame, could have chosen an outer ring location where land was cheaper and it had more room to grow. but instead it put one campus right next to two other universities, not far from here on Broadway, and another one in Darlinghurst. And as an old Melbourne girl, I can't help noticing that the new inner-city Docklands district includes a football stadium. Meanwhile, VFL Park, the suburban ground that was once one of the Code's premier grounds, is no longer used for public matches, and its oceans of car parking have been turned over to housing. I also can't help noticing how difficult it seems to be to grow the smaller cities of this country relative to the bigger cities, with the possible exceptions of Newcastle and Geelong, maybe Bendigo and Ballarat. There aren't that many centres outside the state capitals, where I put Gold Coast as part of Brisbane in that it's really just one conurbation. There's not that many centres that are discontiguous from the state capitals that have many corporate headquarters or all the other things that serve as job magnets. And these self-sustaining job magnets seem to be necessary to create the variety of job opportunities that would attract large numbers of former city dwellers. Over recent years, at least, these smaller centres had rates of employment growth and changes in the employment to population ratios that were similar to or a little below those in the big cities, and they were a bit below the rates of employment growth and employment to population ratio changes in the inner city areas of the big cities. So at this rate, it's going to be hard for the smaller centres to start catching up with the bigger centres, relatively speaking. And what that means is if big city housing prices rise too high for some residents, smaller cities won't be providing alternative locations that are any more viable than they are today. Instead of jobs coming to people, at least some of the people have been coming to the jobs enabled by the pattern of building. I talked about this a little bit last year. In recent years, not only is a lot of the new housing in infill developments, it's much more likely to take the form of high-rise apartments than in the past. And as such, much of the building has occurred in inner areas, so their density of dwellings has increased along with middle and outer ring areas. And you can see that the sort of the percentage change in density is often quite, not so much right in the very centre, but just outside in that inner ring is often a lot denser. The percentage increase in the number of dwellings estimated from building approvals is actually a little bit denser. Now, because in Melbourne the CBD has seen a lot of building, of course, because this flow of new buildings is always a small part of the stock, it will take a long time for this to change the overall housing mix by much. But slowly, Australia's cities are taking on a more internationally typical form, with more apartments and medium density, and a smaller but still large fraction of detached houses on large blocks of land. Another way that people can come to the jobs is, of course, transport infrastructure. And by this I mean transport infrastructure within cities. Our low-density cities do make this more difficult than in most comparable countries. Some transport modes just aren't economic at low densities. And as the history of VFL Park shows, it's hard to make social facilities and centres work without access to transport options other than cars. Of course, many of these choices are shaped by planning policy. Government policy in some states tries to encourage infill over fringe development. In some cases, a full user pays model is applied for local infrastructure instead of clawing back costs over time through property and land taxes, as one might see in the US. So the upfront price appears higher, even though the total cost of ownership, including taxes, is not so different. Costs can also rise if planning rules unduly delay developments, though we are hearing that those kind of constraints have eased a bit lately. So now you might see what the financial stability angle is in all of this. There certainly is one. It's about how all these spatial factors influence the dynamics of demand and supply for housing, and what that all means for prices, debt, and risk. On the supply side, we've already noted the shift to apartment building in recent years. People increasingly have the choice of cheaper housing closer to the centre than used to be available, if they're willing to choose smaller dwellings. But infill, especially large apartment projects, can be slower to develop and build than tracts of detached houses on greenfield sites. So supply is more sluggish. And sluggish supply means prices can get up more of a head of steam before that supply comes online. This isn't a great outcome on some levels, but it has the advantage that it's less likely that an Irish-style or Spanish-style building boom will occur, which would then lead to overbuilding and ultimately a severe slump in prices and increased financial distress. On the other hand, it makes it more difficult to accommodate sudden surges in population growth through migration, which is what Australia has seen since 2005. The accumulation of individual decisions and government policies over many years has given us comparatively low-density cities that create those large price premiums for the most convenient districts in those cities. And if prices rise beyond people's comfort levels, it's not always feasible or attractive for households to respond by voting with their feet and moving to cheaper areas, especially if that means moving out of a state capital and further away from work. So an increase in investor demand in Australia for housing has less of a safety valve because potential home buyers in the same place are less likely to reduce their net demand for housing in that district. Even those who react by choosing not to buy now are still adding to demand for the rental stock, which actually makes rental housing a more attractive investment for the investors. Our low-density cities have developed out of a post-war vision of Australian cities of detached houses on quarter-acre blocks. State and federal war service homes programs were designed on that vision. Planning regulation enforced it. As a mode of living, low-density suburbia has its advantages. But it does mean that distances are greater and almost every trip requires a car. The only alternative offered at the time of our first mass suburbanisation seemed to be the tower in the park, Le Corbusier's utopian dream of apartment living. But the reality turned out to be a nightmare of social isolation for the public housing tenants that were put into those developments. Now, let me be absolutely clear, that I'm not saying that low-density detached housing options should be phased out. Far from it. It's the preferred choice for many households. But it isn't for everyone. In the end, the aim should be to provide better choices and a wider range of choices. I'm hopeful that the future brings Australians a wider range of places that they'd be happy to move to. Different housing types for different family sizes and life stages, and a greater confidence that centres outside state capitals can offer strong job markets and scope for entrepreneurship that people need and housing at a price that they can better afford. That way, when people see an upswing in housing prices in the larger centres, they can look at that and say, I don't have to buy into that. I don't have to stretch my finances. Now, Australian household finances are not looking that stretched at the moment, and we'd like to see it stay that way. As we've said many times in the past, the 15 years or so to about 2005 saw housing prices rise noticeably faster than incomes. This was in large part a transition to a new equilibrium of lower inflation and lower nominal interest rates, and thus higher housing debt and housing prices relative to income. That transition is over now. Housing prices are therefore going to be cycling around a slower trend than they did in the past. There'll be more periods where prices are falling a little in absolute terms. At an individual level, this means there's less scope for rising markets to cover over your mistake if you've fallen in love with a property and overpay for it. At an aggregate level, it means that there's little room for another round of property exuberance of the type we saw just over a decade ago, in 2002 and 2003. Australia managed to have its housing boom end without a major disaster. There were some other countries that weren't so lucky. Usually it's the property developers that are the source of loan defaults and financial instability, not the households with mortgages. It's an important point to remember. But an overstretched household sector is hardly a good environment to have if something else should go wrong with the economy. And that's why the Reserve Bank and APRA have emphasised loan serviceability so much of late. Lenders have become more sophisticated in the ways they assess households' capacity to repay mortgage loans. Most of them have moved beyond a crude approach of applying a blanket repayment to income test. They're now more likely to take people's actual living expenses into account, not just some version of the Henderson poverty line. After all, it doesn't seem reasonable to expect someone to live on a poverty line lifestyle when they've got a $1 million house. Importantly, lenders are now more likely to apply an add-on to current interest rates when calculating the repayment they use in their serviceability tests. So as interest rates fall, the maximum size of loan that borrowers are offered doesn't increase as much, if at all. This is a prudent practice, and at the margin, it has probably reduced the risk in the mortgage book. It's fair to say that serviceability calculations are binding for first home buyers and less binding for trade-up buyers and investors. So it's no surprise that as interest rates have fallen, it's the trade-up buyers and investors whose demand has increased. Meanwhile, first home buyers will feel squeezed out. This is probably more a cyclical phenomenon than a structural one. It's still probably quite disheartening for potential first home buyers. We recognise that. As such, it would not be a good outcome if they responded by overstretching themselves to try to get in the market during upswings. As well as being against first home buyers' own long-run interests, that would increase risk in the financial system. As experience overseas has shown, you do nobody a favour by trying to solve an affordability issue, by making it easier for people to borrow more than they can reasonably service. That's why the structure of our larger cities and the existence of alternatives to our larger cities are both so important. I'm hopeful that over time, Australia's urban structure can evolve to offer better choices and greater financial stability. This might require some changes to the way we plan, build and live, as well as ongoing prudence in how we borrow. But looking at how much has changed in the past decade, I do believe that it's possible. Thank you very much for your time today.
Okay, we have time for some questions. Yes, at the back, please.
You said that household affordability is not stretched. What was your basis for that recommendation?
I said household finances aren't stretched, and that's a different thing, and I guess there's a number of metrics that we use for that. Loan sizes of new loans to income haven't increased that much. But I think the real corker is the fact that so many people are paying off their existing loans ahead of schedule. That's saying they can manage the required repayment comfortably because they're actually paying more voluntarily.
So based on that, are you seeing that, and we've seen data recently that house price growth is easing back a little bit now, do you see that the risk of a housing bubble or prices escalating is easing now?
Well, I think it's been an interesting balance. As we've said publicly before, the recent run-up in prices was expected that as you lowered interest rates, there would be some effect of that on house prices, and that's a natural part of the transmission mechanism of monetary policy. And the policy challenge is to work out how much of that is the expected amount, the expected transmission of monetary policy, and at what point it's got too far. And certainly the fact that investor housing has been the strongest piece has given us some pause. But I think the point being, and this is why we've emphasised serviceability, the point being that there's only a certain extent to which it can run. The fact that interest rates are low is not allowing people to borrow infinite amounts because of the way that serviceability calculations are being done, and that kind of limits how much people can borrow and therefore how much people can bid up house prices. And so we see that leg of lending standards being incredibly important as doing that. And so as long as that borrowing prudence is there, you know, you can never say never, but at this point in time, as long as that holds, we're not yet seeing. I mean, you think back to what happened in 02 and 03, and you know, all of the metrics are looking very different. And in particular, you know, housing credit growth is not growing that strongly overall. And in fact, you are seeing, although auction clearance rates are still quite high, there are areas where that's not the case. And you are starting to see things come off a little bit. And I think that's just saying, well, interest rates were low. Certain people who weren't so bound by the serviceability requirements were able to bid up house prices a bit. But there's only so many of those people, and there's a point at which you've done that adjustment and then it's done. And so the point is, once you get to that point, you want to make sure that you don't say, oh, you know, house prices are so high now, we need to make sure that people can afford these house prices by letting them borrow more. I mean, that's what happened in the subprime crisis in the US, and that's where the disasters can go wrong.
So are you saying that from that there's very little chance that then in Australia there would be any support or need then for any sort of macroprudential controls? And yet we saw from the OECD that they said it should remain on the table to be considered.
Well, I think prudential policy and prudential supervision is always an important part of the toolkit for responding to financial stability risks. That's why APRA has a financial stability mandate. But where the Australian authorities have tended to depart from some of the other people who've talked about this globally, is we don't see much value in carving out a particular aspect of the prudential framework under separate governance and manipulating it separately. I mean, when we're talking about leaning on serviceability and making sure serviceability is being tightly controlled, that's prudential. And because it's for systemic risk reasons, you can call it macroprudential, but we just call it competent prudential.
Anecdotally, Chinese buying has attracted a lot of attention.
Thank you. So, and it's outside your domestic monetary policy controls. Is the Reserve Bank concerned about the size of this? Have you got any measure on offshore buying?
Well, I would just note that there is a Senate inquiry running at the moment on this, and I think the facts about foreign buying of property will come out there. I will note that there has also been a large number of Australian residents who happen to come from China, you know, Greater China, and I wonder whether some of the more sort of, you know, high temperature commentary about this has not been able to distinguish between people who have moved here versus people who don't live here. And I think the numbers will come out on that in the course of that Senate inquiry.